Molly.
Man. Okay, now. Street Fighter V beta is completely fucked, you say? Well, at least they're consistent. This person getting in the... Alright, I'm just going to pull out in front of this guy and do what I need to do. Yeah. This guy want to get in? What do you actually... Put on a blinker. If you want to make a fucking move, put on a fucking blinker. It's as easy as that. There you go. Have I tried Prey? Yeah, I played, I talked about it on the podcast. I haven't played it since the podcast. But I've played about 5 hours of it, I guess. Parts of it seem really neat. I think it's unsettling in a way that a lot of games are not, and I appreciate that. Like, it's creepy, you know? But also, I think the combat is really clunky and kind of fucked up. And in some ways, that kind of helps with the creepy vibe because you feel kind of ill-equipped to handle shit. But at the same time, yeah, it doesn't... I don't know. I don't think it feels great. I don't think the melee combat feels very good. And the weapons, the guns seem kind of rough, too. And it's, you know, it sounds like it's very buggy as well. I haven't encountered anything too bad. I guess I haven't really encountered much. I've been playing it on a PC. And yeah, I know, like, Brad has played more than I have, and he definitely got some cases where he just kind of got stuck and had to reload. Some other people I know have run into similarly messed up things, so it sounds like it's just rough. So maybe you give it some time and have them iron it out. Maybe it'll get to a point where it's cool, but it sounds like it's got some really rough stuff in there. It sounds like the PlayStation 4 version is especially bad, just in terms of control, like the player movement and just like the dead zone, you know, just like there's an extra level of latency on the controls in that PS4 version that you definitely don't want to touch right now. And the Xbox One version sounds like it does not have that issue. But also, I started playing the PC version with a controller and thought that felt awful. Just for as much as the combat is kind of wonky, or, you know, it's just you know, the enemies are very skittery and weird things to fight, and you kind of want the fast-turning radius of a mouse to deal with that. The controller stuff, I think, is a really... I think a controller is a really bad way to play that game, but even still... even still, you know, even with a mouse, it still felt kind of off to me. I don't know. Seems like it has potential, but it also just seems like it's had a rough launch, which I guess... it's what those guys do. They launch rough games, right? The Hitman thing. You know, you see people throwing around sales figures and saying that Hitman didn't sell as much as the last Hitman game and stuff like that. It's hard to really get a sense for how much that matters without knowing, like, what their budget was and how much they spent on Hitman and all that sort of stuff. I think they've hit upon a formula that works really well for Hitman for a wider audience to get into it. And I think they should make more of that. I think that's they've done the episodic thing really well. And I've seen people say, like, oh, you know, yeah, well, you know, it was episodic, so fuck that. It's like, no, you, like, that game, like, Hitman, just generally speaking, I think Hitman works better in this episodic format than it has outside of it. By limiting the levels you get to, you know, experience in one go, you kind of have reasons to go back into those levels and do cool shit, and I think that they've, that's a, it's a really good formula for them. So yeah, I don't know, like, hey, whoa, fucker, yeah, just fucking merge into me, asshole. So, yeah, I don't know. I think that Square is fucking dumb for not wanting to keep that developer in their portfolio, but I guess I just don't really know enough about Square's business. I don't think Square is really set up to properly take advantage of a developer like that anyway. It just it doesn't fit with their profile, you know, their portfolio, maybe. So whatever, you know, you want to think that someone else will come in and pick that up and pick up Hitman along with it. I have to assume that stuff's on the table, because at some point, if you're just buying the studio and not any of the IP, then why don't you just go hire the heads of the studio, set up a new studio, and hire all those people? You wouldn't need to buy anything from Square. Mm-hmm. Unless it's coming with the IP. Sony should buy IO and Hitman. Yeah, that'd be smart. That's way too smart for Sony to do. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I think IO's done some good work. I think they've also done some pretty disappointing work in the past as well. And I was not a big Hitman fan. This is the first Hitman game I've really, really gotten into. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. But, they definitely seem like a studio on the rise, a studio with a lot of potential, and a studio that has figured some shit out, both about this game that they've been making for a very long time. Like, it feels like they learned some new shit, some new ways to expose people to it, and some new ways to package it up. And I think that their tech is solid, and they've done good work with on the tech front, too. So, you know, I think they've got something to offer. For sure, so who knows how that goes. I don't really know what other major publisher would be in a position to pick it all up. I mean, you know, there are publishers that have money that are kind of trying to make a name for themselves and trying to rise up and grow, and yeah, just go. Weird person. Just pull out in front of me, it's fine. I could see, like, a 505 or THQ Nordic or, you know, one of those types of publishers that, like, would really benefit from a name like Hitman in their portfolio. I could see a studio like that looking to make a move. You really doubt the Hitman license is for sale. It kind of has to be. Again, like what... A, Square would do nothing with it. B, if you're not selling the IP with the studio, what is anyone getting? There's no value to the IO Interactive name. So again, like, someone would just come in and say, "Hey, why don't you guys all quit and we'll found a new studio tomorrow, and you guys can walk across the street and get back to work making a new game." So, you know, as with anything. As with all business, everything is on the table for the right price. Like don't be crazy and think that, like, oh, well, they're definitely not going to sell Hitman. Like, no, anyone will sell anything for the right amount of money. So, it would be dumb, I think. Which, whatever, I think the whole move is dumb, so who could say? But, But yeah, selling IO Interactive without the IP. Like, what, you know, are they getting engine tech? Like, I guess that has value if they were selling the whatever the engine that whatever the name of it is, I forget. But if the engine that Hitman runs on comes with it, then that's something. But yeah, if you're going to go in there and negotiate and try to buy IO out from Square, you're going to probably pony up the money for the Hitman IP while you're at it, bare minimum. If not the full attached IP, right? You know, like Kane and Lynch and, I don't know, Mini Ninjas. Maybe EA will buy them and they can finally make a Freedom Fighter sequel. But yeah, it's too early. Like, anyone out there saying, like, oh, it's definitely going to go this way. Like, it's, you know, it's way too early to know how that goes. And IPs can and have changed hands on deals like this before. It's not unheard of. So, expectations and predictions for E3. E3 is going to be a mess. But there'll be some cool shit there, you know. There'll be some stuff. Guy's got a very fancy bike. Now I gotta wait. Alright. I see how it goes. Smart car. He's hosing down the sidewalk, but it kind of looks like he's peeing. Nice work, sir. Fuck is this guy doing? Gotta get past you so I can get in front of you. Like, there's a specific... So, this they changed this intersection I turned left at. It's, like, a couple of one-way streets. And, they changed it in such a way that now the left turn is protected. But it is a red left arrow, which I take to mean, don't go. Usually they also put up signs that say, no turn on red, in a lot of those situations, so, I don't really know, I'm going to assume it is actually illegal to turn on that light, but... But that didn't stop the asshole behind me from honking like he thought I should go. And the three cars in front of me should also have gone, so... Good on him. I have a copy of Cyberbots for the Saturn somewhere that's not in that box, and I don't know where the fuck it is. I know I fucking bought fucking Cyberbots. Where the fuck... I feel like I'm just missing, like, a couple of things. Like, weird stuff that I, you know, certainly wouldn't have gotten rid of, or... stuff that's, like, you know, difficult enough to run that I wouldn't have lent it out. Like, no one's like, hey, can I borrow your Japanese copy of Cyberbots? Like, that's not happening. I want to say that Cyberbots will use the 1 meg cartridge. I'm gonna have to keep digging, I guess. Stop the light, look over, you guys are just talking about basketball. I forget that playoff basketball is happening. Sometimes I think about investing in a few more games for some of those platforms. Like, oh, what if, you know, if maybe I'll buy Cyberbots. I just don't know that I would play that stuff that much. Like, I don't know that I want to build up more of a collection than I really have. You know, Cyberbots is cool, but it's not. If I get, like, a copy of Cyberbots in the box with instructions, you know, just jewel case instructions, whatever, for, like, $10, I would probably do that. I would consider that, at least. Just for fun. Slippery slope. I would consider buying a U.S. copy of Fighters Mega Mix. Man, I could have fucking sworn I had one of those, too. What? Huh. Sega Rally on the stream. No, I don't. I do not have a copy of Sega Rally. Rory really wanted to play Sega Rally, but yeah, and then no one, none of us have it. I want to say that game is relatively expensive for the Saturn these days. That's been the other thing about migrating to this new collection tracking stuff, is that they put price stuff in there in a prominent way. And so seeing prices that are, you know, it's prices that people are trying to get for games, not necessarily sales that went through, I think. Like, it's definitely like a feeling of like, this stuff is, like, gained in value in a way that I guess, like, last time I looked at this stuff, it definitely had not. Like U.S. Saturn games, any Neo Geo Pocket stuff, like, a lot of that has gone up. A lot of U.S. Saturn stuff has gone up. Japanese Saturn stuff didn't seem too crazy, I guess, but I don't know, I haven't really... I haven't really looked too much. Retro bubble is real. Yeah, maybe I should just cash in with some of this stuff, huh? At least some of this sealed stuff that I have. It's like, look, I think Enemy Zero is cool, but I'm not that attached to it. So I've got this sealed copy of it, and I'm like, oh, you know, maybe I could just turn that into Cyberbots. That's my Cyberbots money. Yeah, I was looking at that this morning. Yeah, $250 for Enemy Zero on Amazon, and, like, there are sealed copies on eBay for, I want to say, like, $160. Might have been one for $99, though. Like, the Amazon prices are all ridiculous because they're trying to catch people that just, like, go to Amazon and type in a thing and don't think to check anywhere else. But I wonder how many people actually fall for that shit. How did I just end up in this lane? Going around that turn, did I? Yeah, no. Yeah, like I was talking about this morning, this bus ad just says in big letters, marijuana on demand. And then has a URL. It's from really fucking crazy. How long until that's a Siri interaction or something? It's like, Siri, we need weed. Take me to the drugs. The drug zone, the D zone. Take me to the place where the shoes are thrown over the power lines. I should look at a list of Saturn games, though, see if there's anything else that I feel like I absolutely need to have. I feel like the only game I would really kind of keep coming back to that, like, you know, because that's the thing that changes over time, right, is, you know, like, in its day, like, oh, yeah, Street Fighter Alpha 2, let's play it on the Saturn, that's the best place to play it, and now you're like, yo, what if we just got the arcade version and just, you know, just played that on a computer? Or I bought Alpha 2, the CPS board. So, The Saturn version's cool and all, but hey. So it starts to become like, okay, well, what are the games you can kind of only get on the Saturn, or where the home version on the Saturn did things that an arcade version or some other port of the game didn't do, and, you know, that sort of stuff. Like, that becomes the legacy of the system, right? Like, a lot of the other stuff, it's easy to kind of forget about with where we're at in terms of just, like, accessibility to arcade games in the home and all that sort of stuff. Like, it's a very different story, you know? Whereas at one point, you would think, like, oh, man, that PC version of Mortal Kombat 1 was the best home version. Even though it only supported 4-button pads, like Gravis gamepads, like, and it's a 5-button game, like, that's, it still looks the best, it sounds the best, like, it is closest to the arcade version you can get. But now you just, you know, just get the arcade version. It's like, you're done. It's not really a thing anymore. I mean, there can be interesting things to be found in all those ports, but then at that point, it's almost the opposite, where you're like, let's look at the Genesis version of it, of Mortal Kombat, because of how fucked up it is. Or let's go see how many floppy disks it took to load the Amiga version of MK. And that's the, you know, like, the thing about, like, approaching a lot of these platforms with, like, without nostalgia for them, like the old ZX Spectrum. Which, you know, tons of people in the United Kingdom fucking swear by it. They grew up with it. It's an amazing platform. It's tons of great tapes they loaded, and it took 28 minutes to load this game, and that's awesome, and all that sort of stuff. But now it's only, like, coming at it now, it's interesting as a curiosity, like, the Spectrum is like this one, really. Like, a lot of the games on that thing are ugly as sin. And, you know, they're working within limitations, obviously. You know, like, it's impressive as hell what they got away with on the Spectrum over the years when you look at some of the stuff that appeared on that platform. But if you're looking at it in terms of just like, oh yeah, I want to play Space Harrier 2, that's not the version you're going to play. Unless you have specific nostalgia for that version, it's definitely not. You know, the Genesis version is the best version. It's kind of the original version in that case, I guess. But that got ported to a ton of home computers in really fucked up ways that are just like, oh, this is really cool to look at. Almost like academically. Like, man, look at all the different implementations of these Space Harrier mechanics on all these platforms not powerful enough to run it. In a really traditional way. So, you know, it's cool for that, but it does make it, like, hard to go back and, like, oh, you know, like, if we had to build a canon, the new canon, what are the actual Spectrum games that you need to play? And you might put a couple of arcade ports on there just to be like, hey, you know, just to get a sense of what people were doing on this thing, what they were getting away with, how they were able to program it. Yeah, maybe you can do that. But how many Spectrum-exclusive games? That's the thing, you know, because I'm looking at, like, a fairly complete library of Spectrum games to go, like, okay, well, what's in here? Let's dig through this. And even in those cases, there's usually a better version of that game that appeared on the Commodore 64. You know? So it's kind of hard. It's hard as someone who, you know, only really played a Spectrum game, let's say 10 years ago for the first time, you know, because, you know, that platform just didn't really exist here. Like, it becomes very difficult to get a feel for it, or it becomes very difficult to see why it was special other than, yeah, well, that's what you had, and there were a ton of games on it, and since they were on tapes, you could easily copy them for your friends, so you played a zillion games and fell in love with it. Like, that all makes total sense. And, you know, there are plenty of cases where I would say something like that about the Commodore 64 games, because I had a Commodore, and so I had a lot of great times playing games on that platform. But, yeah, you know, same deal. Like, I played 720 and Paperboy on the Commodore 64 a lot. And I like going back to them because I have that specific nostalgia. But, you know, I'm going like, hey, man, you got to play some fucking Paperboy. Like, that's not going to be the version I'm going to be like, here you go. Because honestly, I don't, you know, in Paperboy's case, I don't know how well that stands up. If someone playing Paperboy for the first time, especially playing it on an analog stick and not a sick set of fucking handlebars bolted to an arcade cabinet. Like, I just don't know how much that stuff stands up. Yeah, no, Jetpack, for sure. Jet Set Willy is... Jet Set Willy, I don't know that I like it very much. But yes, that's... Certainly, there are games that do fit that description. Of like, hey, here's a game that is best known here, and all that sort of stuff. There was something talking to Paul Barnett when he was in EA that they were had spent some time thinking about, like, what games do you actually feel are must-play games for people, like, getting into game design or getting into game development? Like, what are the games that you would go like, oh, well, you must play this. You must know this. And try to establish, like, does that canon exist? Can that canon exist? And the thinking of, like, oh, actually, maybe it kind of doesn't, just because... Like, yeah, you know, like, Wolfenstein and Doom are incredibly important games. But is there anything to really... Well, yeah, you know, like, what would you learn from them today that wouldn't be... That you would take away from it that you wouldn't necessarily get, like, a better, more modern lesson out of a more modern game. Even if that more modern game is less good and less important than Doom is, like, do you really need to have played it? And I'm sure that there would be some people who would argue that, like, oh, well, you must play Doom because of the way the levels are paced, or the way it handles this one specific thing, or, you know, here are the four important things that game designers could learn from playing Doom that they don't learn, and instead their games are like this, or, you know, certainly that sort of stuff. But if you're not making a game that necessarily is like Doom, or, you know, it has enough time passed that you look at it and think, like, well, you know, or it just doesn't, like, it's hard to get the message out of it because so much time has passed and because it is such a different game. big movies are different, right? I mean, there are movies that stand the test of time in a very direct way, and you can still look at it. You know, it's like first, sure, like the medium of film has changed. Technology has seen to that. But a lot of the lessons of like pacing in a scene and shot composition and that sort of stuff, like that stuff does still apply. I just wonder, you know, and I'm not really in a position to know the answer, you know, on account of I don't make video games. But I wonder, like, how relevant are old games truly relevant to modern game design? Or does it just kind of, is it just a profession that keeps eating its own young and pushing forward? Like to think like, oh, there's a ton of lessons, but man, if only people went back and played Syndicate, only people went back and played Populous, then maybe today's games would be better. But you know, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. As much as I love those two games, because at some point, you know, a lot of it is, you know, disciplinary, you know, or split up into disciplines, where, like, hey, you're an artist, so these are the tools we're using to make art for this game, and they're going to be humans, or they're going to be tanks, or both, human tanks, so make those in those tools, and there we go. Like, so much of that stuff ends up getting dictated by the capabilities and limitations of the tech, right? Time Splitters 1, all you need to know about first-person shooters. Like, no. Like, what are today's games taking from Time Splitters? Like, what have today's games learned from Time Splitters? You could argue that if you went back to GoldenEye, like, that was the first? One of the first? I feel like it is usually thrown out as the first game with, like, location-based damage, headshots, and such. But, like, you know, I think the thing you would learn from a game like Time Splitters is, like, here's how to massage these concepts that have typically been done best on the PC onto a console. So, yeah, I don't know that I would say that Time Splitters is surprisingly hard to go back to. Like, I feel like all those games, GoldenEye, Perfect Dark, all the Time Splitters games, like, were immediately obsolete. Or not immediately, but, you know, like some time passed and the people's access to the internet changed and the expectations of what a console first-person shooter is changed. And, like, that stuff, you know, is old. And I feel like a lot of the stuff that makes those games stand out and makes them magical is their point in the point in time upon which, like, they were released. You know? It's a very great meeting of, you know, it's the right game at the right time for the right audience. And so if you're like, okay, well, nowadays we, you know, we can play all these games on the internet and do all this stuff. Like, well, you know, yeah, okay. Like, is that Time Splitters still? If they, if they really lean into that stuff? Or is it just like, hey, we made a shooter and it has modes that, you know, are not like the modes that every other shooter has. They are, in fact, the modes that the old Time Splitters games had. But is that still going to be evocative enough? If you put in, like, oh, well, there's a monkey, and you got to do the, well, you got to shoot, well, like, is that enough? I don't think so. I think that like we're in a phase of first person shooters now, particularly on consoles, where that stuff has been locked down and solved, I guess, in a way that like the Time Splitters games always felt like they were halfway to solving the issue of how to play those types of games on a controller. And then I think, you know, like, I would say that Halo came along and really, like, solidified a lot of things for shooters on consoles. Then, you know, GoldenEye started the work on that, certainly. It's, you know, I think GoldenEye is a very important game, but I also think it is aged fucking terribly. And then I think you had Call of Duty 4 come out and like, kind of finish that stuff. Not to say that, like, Call of Duty 2 didn't also have a lot of that same stuff, but just in terms of... you know, how to balance, like, this melee with this ranged, with, you know, these thrown grenades, that, you know, like... the pace of that combat, the way it controls, the snappiness of the control, the way it aims, the way it auto-aims, especially the way it auto-aims. I mean, if you think about snapping two targets and stuff like that, right, like, that is a big part of making those games work on console, is adapting to the platform, adapting to the limitations of the platform, and being totally okay with that. It's not some blasphemous thing. Like, oh my god, auto-aim. It's like, no, that's fine. An analog stick is less precise than a mouse. Like, no one's arguing the point there. It's not like you're allowing those two input devices to compete with each other in an unfair way. So, whatever. Who cares? Now I think we're still in that phase, right? I mean, that's still sort of the mode that everyone's in, and I wonder if, I wonder when all that stuff will get thrown out, and I really wonder what will replace it. You know, will we enter, like, a new phase of first-person shooting, where it's just like, oh, but this is, like, a totally different paradigm for how we think of these types of games on these types of devices. Or, you know, at some point, God, at some point does someone nail down touchscreen control for shooters in such a solid way that becomes the thing, right? It sounds fucking crazy, but, like, that's what everyone thought about console, like, first-person shooters on consoles, too. Yeah, I guess you could look at VR and that type of motion control and say that's probably the thing, but if that's going to be the thing, it's not going to be the thing today, tomorrow. It's going to be a while before that's a mass market thing. And I think that, like, that's, you know, like, you can have games that push things forward, but are not necessarily the games that are the like, cultural touchstones that really move things forward. You know, you're going to have Killswitch before you have Gears of War, but people aren't necessarily talking about Killswitch a lot these days. So I do think, you know, like, yeah, you know, like, someone will nail shooting in VR early, right? Someone will eventually, like figure it out and be like, man, we did it. But they might not be the ones to actually reap the benefit. They might nail it, and then a big publisher might see it and go, oh, okay. We're going to do that. But we're going to make these tweaks, and, you know, we have enough data coming in to have this spin on these concepts to really, truly lock it down. Yeah, the inside-out tracking stuff could be a very big deal. Whatever, that will be a big deal. I mean, everyone's working on that stuff now, right? I mean, certainly Oculus has their own prototypes for that sort of stuff. I believe they showed something off at their last dev thing that was like, hey, here's the thing, I don't know, inside-out tracking, it's, you know, we're thinking about it, we're definitely working on it. Because hanging up stuff around the room is just not, that is not a mass-market device as long as you're doing that shit. Here, let me use fucking, what, 4 USB 3 ports? No, I guess it's 3, right? So, it's one for the Rift, and then one for each camera. That's what it is. But if you want to do full room scale, then that's one more sensor. At least 4 USB 3 ports. Overrunning your bus, you're like, okay, I gotta plug 2 of these in the front and 2 in the back. Like, every time we do Rift stuff in the office, like, figuring out which fucking USB ports I need to plug shit into to make everything work all at once is a ridiculous puzzle. I feel like I'm defusing a fucking bomb. So inside-out tracking, you know, like if they can get that to work as well as their current tracking solutions, which I suspect they'll totally be able to do it, then great. That's less setup. That's, you know, it makes the devices more accessible to more people because not everyone's going to be able to put things on their walls or string stuff around a room. They might have a smaller room. They might have, you know, like the room I was doing VR stuff in at home was just about big enough to sort of do it. But I would end up getting so close to the sensors in some cases that I would just disappear. Even though I was technically in the square that I had drawn, it was still like, oh, I'm too close to the sensor, or the sensor can't see me from here because it's up high pointing down, and I'm eye level with it, or, you know, or whatever. And setting that stuff up just sucks. It just sucks. Every time we want to do, like, a VR thing, it's like, you know, we don't leave that stuff set up all the time. The Vive lighthouses are up all the time, I guess, but you know, every time I have to, because they have to be set on tables or, you know, stands or whatever, like, okay, I'm going to plug in the Rift sensors, and I need to set them just so, and then, okay, this is all set up, don't anyone fucking bump this table, or we're fucked. Like, that stuff just, you know, at home, obviously, you're going to have a more, you would theoretically have the ability to have a more rigid setup that's not going to be a problem. Like this first wave, this first gen VR stuff is fucking rad. It's so fucking cool that it exists at all, man. But I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. Like, anyone buying this stuff doesn't need a recommendation because they know they need it. Anyone on the fence about it should wait until it makes more sense. And stuff like Inside Out tracking, that'll go a long way to that. Here, just put the thing on. It's fine. It'll work. It's fine. In fact, when they can get there, great. Awesome. Perfect. I do wonder, like, if that stuff's ever gonna truly catch on, or how it does, or, like, the thing I've been noticing, like, more and more is, like, that idea of, like, completely cutting myself off from the outside world. It's just not something I can do for a long period of time. Like, playing a long VR game in one session is out of the question. I've got stuff going on. Like, I need to pause games and walk away and do stuff and come back and, you know, like. I need to stop for a sec to answer a question from my wife, or I need to, you know, answer the door. I need to, you know, like, is the cat in here? I can't step on the cat. What's it? Okay, are we fine? You know, like, just the sensory deprivation aspect of VR is just kind of a tough thing to fit into your life. Tough thing to fit in my life. I mean, yeah. I'm sure for some people it's not an issue, but well, like, I'm at a point now where, you know, and you could say that this is a problem and that this is bad for humanity or something like that, and that our attention spans are being decimated by our lifestyles and stuff, but if you count my phone, I usually have 4 screens around me at home when I'm in my office. I've got my TV, I've got 2 PC monitors, and I've got my phone. Sometimes I also have my laptop up, depending on what I'm doing. And so, you know, everyone wants to divide their attention. And, like, VR prevents that. And so, in some ways, it actually, like, raises the, like, it makes it harder. Like VR has to clear a much higher bar for coolness and all this other stuff, because it has to compete with 100% of everything else I could be doing or would be doing. Like, oh, and on my second monitor, I've got this chat window open that I'm kind of keeping an eye on. I'm going to jump in here and say something to these people over here, and, like, oh, I've got Twitter up over here, or I've got a video playing on the second monitor while I do work over here on this, and I also have a game paused on the TV that I'm kind of going back to here and there, you know, like, I hear a lot of people doing that sort of stuff these days, you know, like, honestly, that's a, you know, we put up long videos, and I know that there are plenty of people, we do long podcasts, well, here, we do long podcasts, and then we see people complaining about things that we didn't say in the podcasts. You're like, oh, all right, so you had this on in the background while you're doing 5 other things, half listened to it, and now you're mad. Like, eh. Like, whatever, I can't get mad at it. Like, I probably have done the same thing. There's a guy out here riding a bike, weaving around like a fucking lunatic. Like, now that there's a bike lane, there was no bike lane, so he was kind of in a lane, and that's all fucked up. Now there is a bike lane, and he's deliberately not riding in the bike lane. I'm trying to fucking prove a point, or trying to die, I'm not sure. But I see that, you know, like, that's the problem with VR, is that it doesn't just have to be, like, VR games don't just have to be, like, better than other games you could be playing. It has to then be better than the game you could be playing while you have this other thing up in another window, while you are looking at your phone from time to time, while you are, you know, like, all that sort of stuff. Like, that's impossible. Or it's a very tall order. And it's why, you know, like, eventually, you know, if the tech progresses and all this sort of stuff, AR will be the winner. You know, AR goggles that you could black out to do VR, but can very quickly bring you back into the real world for a moment. Of like, pause this and now I can see. I don't have to take anything off. I don't have to fucking jack the fuck out. You know, so maybe that problem gets just solved by the technology and it's not really an issue anymore. But with where we're at right now, like, it's just, it's hard for me to fit VR into my schedule. It's just not. Most of it's not compelling enough to win out over all that other stuff. And it's fun, like, you know, so like, VR almost becomes like a relaxation exercise, like the Oculus Medium sculpting stuff. Like, I was doing that for a while and it was just like, it was nice. It was like, I'm going to go away for a while and I'm going to sculpt some stuff. That was fun. Like, really, but it felt like I was getting away. Someone will figure it out. Not me. Someone. Someone smarter than me. I'll figure it out and probably make a lot of money. Alright, I'm gonna go. I'm home. It's fantastic. You know. We'll do this again in the morning. I'll see you later. Have a good night.